The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashemi. Thanks so much for being with us. Now, the United States is anything but united these days. Inside the country lies much discontent and a major divide. And outside the country, even Washington's allies are starting to say that the U.S. hegemony is waning rapidly, especially after the Afghanistan debacle. Are we looking at the beginning of the end of the American empire, or are we rapidly approaching its dissolution? Stay with us as we take a look at all of this and more on this Spotlight.
Weeks after the Taliban swept to power in Afghanistan, the world is still evaluating the results of the West's 20-year-long war in the country. The United States have faced criticism over its messy withdrawal from Afghanistan and its achievements in the Central Asian country. The unexpectedly rapid fall of the Afghan capital, the scenes of chaos at the Kabul International Airport where hundreds of people desperate to leave the country had gathered, and the bomb attack claimed by the Daesh terror group that killed over 170 people, including 13 U.S. troops, have all raised questions about the U.S. military superiority. That's an issue British Defense Secretary Ben Wallace raised in an interview with The Spectator magazine.
It's obvious that Britain is not a superpower, but a superpower that is also not prepared to stick at something isn't probably a superpower either. It is certainly not a global force, it's just a big power.
This wasn't the first time that the British Defense Secretary has criticized Washington, a close UK ally. Back in August, he said former US President Donald Trump's decision to clinch a deal with the Taliban was a mistake.
I would say if it's a superpower or not is pretty irrelevant. The United States is still the greatest danger facing the world and the greatest concentration of private power against our species that has ever existed.
While the U.S. threatens military action against nations it deems its adversaries, including Iran, Russia, and China, it appears that more Washington allies are beginning to take up the opinion that America has lost its superpower status.
I'd like to welcome my guests to the Spotlight, Senior Analyst, Foreign Policy and Focus, Ian Williams, out of New York. And journalist and political analyst Elijah Matnier out of Brussels.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you both for being with us. Let's start this off with Ian in New York. Ian, do you think that the U.S. is waning? And if so, when do you think this actually started? Some say from 1971 when gold no longer backed the dollar. Others say since the U.S. invaded Afghanistan and Iraq. I mean, what's your assessment of this overall?
It's very difficult to say. Oh, it's been waning almost the minute it was established because people successfully stood against it. You could say that the Vietnamese victory against the U.S. was a clear signal, but it was definitely at its height after the fall of the Berlin Wall after the fall of the Soviet Union and with the Iraq War, the US was unchallenged internationally. Even its enemies didn't really dare go against it. That's been eroded totally. But what happened in Afghanistan was not significant in economic or military terms. It was significant in terms of prestige, which, as far as global diplomacy is concerned, is almost as important. But people are still going to think twice before they challenge the US. They still have hugely disproportionate armed forces. They still have hugely disproportionate financial support, less so than it was, and it's definitely waning, and a lot less quickly than some of us would have hoped, perhaps. But it's also got rising, it's got rising rivals, in particular China. I don't really think that Russia is one of the major rivals. It's Russia is sort of Saudi Arabia with nuclear weapons. It doesn't have a massive economy, but it does have this residual armed forces and nuclear weapons. China is a rising power in every sense, and obviously the US is scared about it. But once again, the US isn't unrivaled there, and China can't really exploit the US's weakness, because one of the reasons why China has been rising is because it sells so much of its goods to the United States, and it borrows so much money from the United States, it lends so much money to the United States. So they're inextricably bound together. It's not a straight one-on-one superpower confrontation like Moscow and Washington in what you might say the bad old days, when they really didn't have that much to do with each other. There was almost minimal contact in culturally, financially, and other ways. But the United States is a victim of its own failures.
Stay with me. Let me. We're going to talk about the reasons for this, but let me get Elijah in on this conversation. Now, American political scientist Francis Fukuyama says that the truth of the matter is that the end of the American era had come much earlier. The long-term sources of American weakness and decline are more domestic than international. What do you think about that?
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming.
I think the decline of the U.S. forces started not when the U.S. was engaged in war, like in Lebanon 1982 or 1983, in Iraq in 2003, in Syria 2011. It is, what is the outcome of all these wars? Of course, the U.S. has the strongest military machine and military power, but what is the result of this machine? Winning the ground and then not be able to hold it. It's exactly the same as ISIS is able today to attack small villages and win and then withdraw. But the U.S. is able to stay for much longer, for many years, and then being kicked out and forced to withdraw. The moment the Americans sit with the Taliban and negotiate a peace deal is the moment of the decline and the defeat of the U.S. after 20 years. So there is no point for the U.S. to have so much the mighty military power when the result is very slim at the end of the day. So yes, it is a decline of the empire. It is the rising of other forces that not only are rival, but also are defying the U.S. and challenging the U.S. Forces, even if they don't stand to the exact U.S. Military power. And they have a minor force, but however they can and they are able to defy the U.S. Like we've seen that in Iran, we've seen that in Syria, we've seen that in Lebanon, and we've seen that in Iraq, even a small group. And the Taliban managed to stand against the Americans and force the withdrawal. So yes, I think the U.S. Defense Secretary is quite right by saying it is just a big power, but it's big power not able to reach the end, achieve anything at the end of the day.
Okay, well, Ian, there have always been different opinions in the U.S., like most places, but it was magnified greatly during the Trump era. How divided do you actually think the country is currently?
It's extremely divided, and I just want to add that the people who brought you the Iraq War were the people behind the Project for the New American Century. And they foresaw this precisely. In their own way, they were clear-sighted. They said America was declining economically, and so they had to cement in a military advantage now to ensure their hegemony over the next few years. And they're proved entirely right, apart from the fact of being hopelessly optimistic. And what we're seeing now is there's always been a problem with American foreign policy. It's never been, it's never been joined up. It's a result of different lobbies, of forces within there. It's almost Byzantine in the way that the State Department, the Pentagon, the military industrial contractors, the politicians representing the lobbies, where they kick things around until it comes. And then, in the past, you had the State Department acting like a gyroscope and saying, well, yes, you might want that, but international law says no. Jerusalem is not Israel's capital. Or international law says no, Western Sahara is not part of Morocco, no matter what the President of the United States says. But that type of moderating influence is almost gone, because one of the things that Trump and the ideologues did was to wage a complete war against the State Department and the more rational aspects of the American foreign policy establishment. So in that sense, what Joe Biden has done is entirely rational. He said, we can't win in Afghanistan. Afghanistan is not one of our essential, it's not one of our essential fields of operation for the United States. The United States interests are not inextricably bound up there. Prestige might be, but we can live with their prestige. We're still the biggest military in the world. And then, the old story about sticks and stones may break my bones, but the names will not be okay. I'm not the big superpower. Try anything on me and see what I do. It's a rational position that Biden's taken, but it is symbolic of American decline and the decline of the decision-making apparatus that universally the political, military, and intelligence people let Biden down so thoroughly that he did not know that the Taliban had basically entered into an agreement and they bought the Afghan army wholesale on the ground, unit by unit.
You talked about that it's the logical thing to do, the rational thing to do. I think probably the question, though, for the American people and much of the world would be the way that they did what they did and why that they leave in the way that they did and cause such chaos. And what does that do to the American psyche itself? Because the American people, first of all, don't like to believe that they've been beaten, that they've lost the war, number one. And second of all, they don't like to hear that some have been left behind and basically American troops are running out of Afghanistan. I mean, what has that done in general for the American psyche inside of the country?
The American psyche, as far as I can see, is completely unflappable. Really, they really don't care. Afghanistan is a faraway country with a strange-sounding name, and most Americans are just happy to get out of there. Some of them might see it as a blot on their escutcheon, but another way of looking at it, if you're being rational, bearing in mind that it was a completely unprecedented collapse, that was the real failure, the fact that that wasn't anticipated. The U.S. showed its power. It got out over 100,000 people in a very short time from allegedly a hostile territory with very few casualties and very few left behind. It's shameful, but actually that shame is mostly brought on by the Trump people who brought about the debacle to begin with, who are picking on Biden for partisan points. I'm not a fan of Biden, but this was one of the more rational things, and a lot of what he's been accused of goes squarely back to Donald Trump and the Republicans who started this thing. Now, okay. Biden was one of the cheerleaders for those foreign adventures as part of the sort of neocon conspiracy to defend Israel. But on this particular aspect, he was clear-sighted. We couldn't win enough, and we have to get out.
Elijah, your assessment of it all, and what do you see as the main causes of the U.S.'s deterioration?
I think there are many points here. It is not only the rush that the U.S. left Afghanistan. It is only it's also the behavior toward the allies. I mean, here Europe is under shock to see how the U.S. withdrew without even consulting Europe, and the way they withdrew without talking to the allies. And this is why we're here today to talk about the necessity to form a European army, which is very early, and I don't know where this is going to lead us. However, the reason why the U.S. felt in such a hurry to leave is because they had the wrong information, the wrong assessment of the army that they have trained, and they had a very high expectation.
How does that happen? Sorry to jump in here, Elijah. I mean, how does that happen? You say wrong assessment. 20 years. 20 years on the ground. 20 years American troops working or being side by side with Afghan troops, obviously evaluating the situation. How do you get it so wrong after 20 years?
Because the Americans make mistakes after mistakes. This is not the first time. And because they lack also the understanding of the culture, they made this mistake in Iraq severely, and they did it again in Afghanistan when they expected to see the Afghan army engage in a civil war against other Afghani while they are negotiating with them in Qatar and delivering the country back to the Taliban. And they expect the army to fight and give them just 6 months' time so they can pull out all the Americans and the Afghan collaborators. And they say, done, we are out, and now you can continue fighting until you kill each other, and Taliban will again overwhelm all the army that we've trained for 20 years. This is a real failure that we've seen also in Iraq in 2014, where they've trained the army for 11 years, and the Iraqi army crumbled in just 3 days in Mosul and in the north of Iraq. It is not only the failure of the intelligence services, it is not the lack of visibility and right assessment, it is not only the non-understanding of the state and the local culture, it is just everything was going wrong. And because they think, the Americans think, we can import our culture anywhere we go, this is fundamentally wrong. They are never going to change the culture of a country, and it's never going to be customized to the Americans' culture and mentality. Nobody asked the Americans to come, and nobody asked, and they were forced to leave. After 20 years, they removed the Taliban in 2001 to give back the power in 2021 again to the Taliban.
Ian, even during a pandemic and health crisis, we have seen anything but solidarity in the way the American society has approached the issue. I mean, do you attribute this to a major mistrust by many of their leadership overall? And how does this affect the whole, the schism that has come about inside of the country? Is there overall mistrust for the leadership?
Well, I mean, you quoted at the beginning Francis Fukuyama, who wrote just before the end of the Cold War about after the end of the Cold War about the end of history, when in fact history had just restarted where it left off in 1914. And to give him his due, Francis Fukuyama has admitted he was wrong about that thesis. And here, in effect, we're seeing the American Civil War still continuing after 160 years. I mean, the issues of race and privilege and culture are still hugely predominant here. I mean, we have Texas just passed an act which basically encourages vigilantism against women. We have almost post-Reconstruction states legislatures all over the South enacting legislation that makes it almost impossible for minorities and poor people to vote. And this is being done without interference on the federal level. We have a party which tried to stage a coup against its own government on January the 6th. We have a failed president who's proclaiming he's still won. These are not the hallmarks of a sophisticated and balanced society. This is a society that's riven down the middle, and there are people who hate each other. You know, 40% of Americans don't believe you can be patriotic and a Democrat. They certainly don't believe you can be patriotic and a socialist. They have their own very peculiar definitions, and it's a society that's based on exclusion and hatred on their part. They're actually dying in thousands because they think that wearing masks is a form of subservience to socialism, to galloping communism. They're refusing vaccinations in the middle of a death-dealing plague. I mean, you know, it's difficult. The German word is Schadenfreude, to take pleasure at the misfortunes and others. But I can't help grinning every time I see the latest right-wing radio commentator dying of COVID after he's run his latest rampage about vaccination and masks. They're still dying, though. Until they hit the hospital bed and the tubes are rammed down their throats, what's coming the other way out of their throats are invocations to resist the government, resist masks, watch out for those Democrats, they're coming after your daughters and everything else. It really is a very sick society, and it goes back to the Civil War, but it was Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan who saw those fissures were still there and started the process of enlarging the fissures, of basically playing the race card, which they've done year after year. And now it's an even bigger, it's a culture card, where, you know, any minorities are the target for vilification and witch hunts. It's not a stable society. And what's worse is that the people who actually make the decisions in Washington, the last 20 years of hollowing out by the Republicans, they've taken away, for years, if you spoke Arabic in the State Department, you were denied promotion. And you were talking about how could they? When the Shah was driven out of Tehran, U.S. mission people were still sending back rosy reports because none of them read Farsi. They didn't see all the graffiti on the street walls saying death to the Shah on their way in. They probably thought it was an advert for Coca-Cola. They did not know what was happening in the country they were stationed in because of their cultural arrogance.
Well, what about that, Elijah? I mean, now when we look at the situation and the overall situation of the U.S., many will say that it's a dying empire. It's under lots of pressure right now as far as its so-called prestige in the world. Other analysts will say it's some of the most dangerous times when an empire feel pressured. Your take on where this can go with the United States basically waning, as Ian said at the beginning, it may be waning, but it still has a lot of power. Your assessment of it at this point in time?
I think we are in a very dangerous situation today. The danger comes from an administration that wants to show that it has not been defeated and it still had the power to do something. And that will take us to the possibility of American just supporting another war somewhere or a battle between in West Asia. Secondly, the Americans, if they are smart enough to understand that they cannot sustain a presence in country where there is no interest to stay, like, for example, in northeast Syria, that is even exactly the same as Afghanistan, is so far, there is no interest for the Americans to stay there. It's staying in Iraq when the population, half of the population at least, is against them and carrying attack. So if they reach this realization that it is time to stop being involved in country that are far, there is no interest for the American, and they have to withdraw, then the world will be really in a better shape.
Okay.
Otherwise, you see really an American administration committing one mistake after another.
Well, Ian, really quickly, I just have a minute, though. But what Elijah said, if they will do this and understand that it's not in their benefit, but one of the things we can look at is, yes, the U.S. hasn't spent a lot of money on its own people and the infrastructure, but it has spent trillions on its wars, and it has benefited the industrial military complex, the 1%. I mean, are we going to see a change? Because basically, what the U.S. is like a major corporation and supporting that 1%. All the others are basically just workers for that 1%. Do you think that we're likely to see a change in tactics, or is it just going to continue until it dissolves?
Actually, I think the Biden administration has done, well, I had low expectations. I think they've done far more than I anticipated in terms of icing the corner for the weaker segments of American society. They're not doing enough, but it's far better. And speaking of weaker segments, I think you mentioned the UK before. The UK, for the last 70 years, has droned on about the special relationship, and it's been revealed once again to be entirely one-sided. Britain sends troops to every war that the Americans send to them. These are the equivalents of the sepoys, the Indian colonial army that the British sent everywhere. So the British have been sent by the Americans to wars all over the world, but things that aren't in British interests were in American interests. And then they were left in Kabul with no attempt to rescue them or consult with them. They were left swinging, like all the other European allies, as Elijah said. I mean, this... If Biden is to be accused of anything, that complete insouciance and contempt for allies will come back to haunt them. The okay. Europeans are going to try and build their own forces. The Taiwanese are going to think to themselves, and the Japanese even are going to think, maybe we need nuclear weapons. If this is what allies do to each other, we need to stand up for ourselves. There are dangerous implications everywhere. There are worse things than a bipolar system. A multipolar system with lots of people waving nukes could be much more dangerous.
Okay, 30 seconds, Elijah. 30 seconds.
I think it's time for the U.S. to realize that stop interfering in other countries' affairs, lift the sanction on Iran, allow Iraq to sort out this problem, and countries in West Asia to talk to each other and keep away, and withdraw all forces. That is a dream. It may come true.
All right. And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with me here on this Spotlight. Senior analyst, foreign policy, and focus Ian Williams out of New York, and journalist and political analyst Elijah McNair out of Brussels. And we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
The thought on my mind that how grateful we are to have you, oh Hussein.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
And I thank you, Allah. I thank you, Allah. I thank you, Allah. I thank you, Allah.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين. ثم الصلاة والسلام على محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran.
In this edition of the program, we are trying to talk about the different verses of the Holy Quran, which are thematically connected to our topic, which is Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. So stay with us, and let's listen to some of the verses.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وَقَرْنَ فِي بُيُوتِكُنَّ وَلَا تَبَرَّجْنَ تَبَرُّجَ الْجَاهِلِيَّةِ الْأُولَى وَأَقِمْنَ الصَّلَاةَ وَآتِينَ الزَّكَاةَ وَأَطِعْنَ اللَّهَ وَرَسُولَهُ.
And abide in your houses, and do not display yourselves as was the display of the former times of ignorance. And establish prayer, and give zakah, and obey Allah and His Messenger. Allah intends only to remove from you the impurity of sin, O people of the Prophet's household, and to purify you with extensive purification.
As you have been previously with us, dear listeners, we concluded that isma and infallibility of Imam Hussein as the isma of all the Ahlul Bayt is not exclusive. Yet what is exclusive is the prophethood and imama, which none can attain with endeavor, even if one is totally purified. So, all human beings can reach this stage of being totally purified, but they cannot reach this stage of prophethood and imama. In the Holy Quran, we read, "Allahu a'lamu haythu yaj'alu risalata." Allah best knows where He places His message. The prophets, 124,000 in number, and the imams after the Holy Prophet are 12 in number. But isma is a station available for anyone, since it has different levels. Lady Fatima alayha salam was neither a prophet nor an imam, but she was ma'soom. Mary too was ma'soom, as we have many traditions. So everyone can enjoy such capacity that he can prepare for himself the ground for the manifestation of such blessing with knowledge and practice, so that Almighty Allah will grant this station of isma to him or her. وَأَتَاكُمْ مِنْ كُلِّ مَا سَأَلْتُمُوا. The Holy Quran clearly says, He gives you of all that you ask Him. This asking is based on talent, and Almighty Allah does not allow any talent to go to waste. One point to take into consideration is the fact that isma and infallibility is an optional virtue in knowledge and action. So it is a virtue. It can be acquired in the light of Almighty Allah's favor. Therefore, if a ma'asum has not done something wrong, it means that he has opted not to commit anything wrong, and not because he has been created ma'asum by nature.
He who loves you admonishes you from wrongdoing, and he who hates you entices you into wrongdoing.
Ma'soom, as the Holy Quran says, is always equipped with divine reasoning internalized in man. And in this way, man have supported the inner enemy and carnal desires. Dear listeners, for further information and explanation in this regard, you can refer to the book Ahlul Bayt, The Celestial Beings on the Earth, available at al-islam.org. A really informative and a rich book that we took great help from. Let's go further on to have a look at sin, but from the viewpoint of the infallibles. A follower of the spiritual path and a ma'asum, they see the evil nature and the result of the sin as it really is. The Holy Quran says, إِنَّ الَّذِينَ يَأْكُلُونَ أَمْوَالَ الْيَتَامَى ظُلْمًا إِنَّمَا يَأْكُلُونَ فِي بُطُونِهِمْ نَارًا وَسَيَصْلَوْنَ سَعِيرًا. As for those who swallow the property of the orphans unjustly, surely they only swallow fire into their bellies. So, this verse does not mean that it is like that they are doing such, but it says that the reality of swallowing the property of the orphans unjustly is this swallowing fire. It is not like swallowing. It is swallowing fire itself. So, since the inner part of sin is fire, one who realizes this is immune from even thinking of sinning. At the end of the story of Aqil, who requested more than his right from the public fund, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, "Have you come to deviate me from the religion of Allah? Or are you mad? Or have some jinn overpowered you? Or are you speaking without senses?" So Imam Ali alayhi salam, who is infallible, sees bribe as the vomit of a serpent that a wise man never longs for. So, from the viewpoint of the infallible, this reality of sin is seen and recognized, and he does not even think of a wrongdoing. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
يا سيدي نسألك الدعاء، يا سيدي نسألك الدعاء، يا سيدي نسألك الدعاء، يا سيدي نسألك الدعاء. دمعت عليك ظلت تنزل جروح، يا ابو اليمة بمصابك ذابت الروح، طلب راي توفقني بخدمتك، ولا تحرمني من الدمع والنور. يا ابو النعمة وباب للرحمة، ادري توفيقي هو اسبابك، الك اسأل وانت تتفضل، من توظفني خادم ببابك. يا سيدي نسألك الدعاء، يا سيدي نسألك الدعاء، يا وجيها سيدي نسألك الدعاء، يا سيدي اشفع لنا.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Around the world with reporters.
A house was recently bombed by a US drone strike. Shrapnels have even damaged the door of the house. 10 members of a single family, including 6 children, lost their lives in the recent U.S. drone strike. As the relatives of the victims say, the owner of the house, which was targeted by the attack, was an engineer with no ties to any terrorist group. Imal Ahmadi is the brother of the owner of the house. He explains how the U.S. airstrike claimed the lives of his beloved ones in a moment.
I had left the house almost 10 minutes before that U.S. brutal attack. I quickly got back after I received a call from a relative. I saw the dead bodies of my brother, his sons and daughters all over the yard.
Blaming the U.S. for launching blind attacks on civilian areas, Imal is also angry on international journalists and the United Nations for what he says turning a blind eye on their misery.
A number of local and international journalists have so far interviewed us, but no one, including the United Nations, has heard our voice. Everybody follows his or her own agenda with paying no attention to our demand. We want justice, and the UN is responsible.
It was August 30 when the U.S. airstrike hit this vehicle inside a house located in northeastern Kabul. Later, Pentagon said that they have successfully eliminated a vehicle packed with explosives in the city of Kabul. However, Taliban urgently condemned the attack, calling it an inhuman assault on civilians. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Turkey has proposed to the European Union a substantial migrant deal. Turkish Foreign Minister said in a joint presser with Dutch Foreign Minister Sigrid Kaag that this time Turkey will not handle the burden of refugees alone and will need a new deal with the EU, unlike the previous one, where the bloc would only pay a certain amount of money and leave Turkey to handle the rest.
On the issue of the Afghan migrants, there will be no such cooperation if the EU's approach would be based on we give money and you keep them there. We have fulfilled our responsibility. The number of migrants trying to go to Europe has decreased 95%, but the EU did not do its part.
Following the Taliban's takeover of Afghanistan, Turkey tightened its security measures at the borders to prevent the wave of Afghan refugee influx to the country. Previously, the Turkish president said, his country has no duty, obligation, or even responsibility to be Europe's refugee warehouse, assuring that international cooperation is needed to prevent a new migration wave from Afghanistan.
There is an urgent need for a new deal for sure. However, this time the deal will be different than the previous one due to the changes that took place worldwide. Not only is it up to EU and Turkey, but also the United States is involved in the issue of Afghan refugees. Turkey now has closed its borders in front of refugees, not only because a deal is not reached yet, but the burden of refugees is actually affecting the AKP internally as well. People have started to feel the burden of migrants and the country and are now pressuring the government to stop receiving them.
The AKP is under pressure from opposition groups and citizens who are calling for a solution for the increasing number of refugees and foreigners residing in the country, which most likely will affect votes in the upcoming elections. Turkish citizens are complaining from unemployment, high demand on real estate, and other problems caused by the fact that Turkey has become a safe haven to those fleeing crisis-hit countries. The Turkish government now has to make a balance between fulfilling the needs of the EU and international community and surrendering to its own people's demand of sending the already existing refugees back. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
As they stood for a photograph ahead of their latest meeting on Friday, EU foreign affairs ministers appeared to be in a jovial mood. However, critics say they have little to laugh about given the West's role in the Afghan crisis. At a press conference following the meeting, it was made clear the EU is not encouraging Afghan refugees to travel to the 27-country bloc.
The own commitments of the Taliban's to let people to go out if they want. It doesn't mean that we have any kind of commitment from the member states to take care of them.
That statement is likely to enrage rights groups and aid agencies. Oxfam had already published a statement accusing the EU of turning its back on Afghan refugees. European Commission data suggests 3.5 million people are currently internally displaced within the country. 1 in 3 are going hungry. 500,000 people are currently trying to leave Afghanistan, according to the Commission. EU lawmakers say it's not fair for the EU to place the responsibility of refugees on neighbouring countries like Pakistan and Iran.
Make sure that they have and they will own their migration crisis and that we stay away from that as best we can. I think that is hypocritical at best.
A coordinated strategy by the EU to the refugee crisis is urgently required, experts argue.
If the European Union was able to react to respond to the refugee challenge collectively, the individual burden for every single country would be much lower.
The role the EU, NATO, Britain and the US played in Afghanistan has been castigated in the European Parliament.
The Americans lied to their people. The Americans spent over $2.2 trillion and over $2 trillion of it went to private contractors.
One legislator suggests the EU misjudged the level of support that exists for the Taliban.
They obviously were appealing for many in Afghanistan because otherwise they hadn't taken over the country so quickly.
Without assistance from the international community, European Commission officials forecast medical supplies will run out in Kabul within 2 weeks, and 120 children in the country could die every single day. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
If you live in England, chances are you're already paying more for your food. And it all begins here. Every year, tens of thousands of people come to work on UK farms from Eastern Europe. This year, the workforce is already down more than 10%. The culprit, farmers and economists say, Brexit.
We, as a farmer, are hugely passionate about employing local people, and there are many roles and career opportunities for local people here, but we simply don't have the people coming forward for the jobs.
Since Brexit, the right for EU workers to just turn up in the UK is no longer. The government quota only allows 30,000 EU labourers onto UK farms now. The industries say they need twice that number.
The cause of that shortage is a mixture of incompetence and hubris, because the British government said, oh yes, we can leave the EU, and after that everything is hunky-dory, we can rely on America.
The labour shortage is not limited to British farms only. They go across the board. The hospitality sector, for example, is 180,000 short. The meat processing sector, 5,000. When there are so many vacancies in so many different sectors in an interconnected economy, that is a problem.
One problem is in the haulage industry. Plenty of work, not enough drivers. With many waiting in long queues to take their driving tests, which stopped during COVID, creating a backlog that snowballed with Brexit, meaning the industry is now 15,000 drivers short. Some have offered a substantial pay rise for drivers to lure more people into the job. Experts say there is a problem with that.
It is far from certain that even a price rise will actually solve the solution. For a start, it's not going to bring back those EU drivers for a start. They've probably gone. So you see, the situation is bad. It doesn't look as though they can solve it at the moment. And it's going to be one of the factors of many putting up the prices very considerably in the shops.
For some industries here, COVID sent thousands of workers home. Brexit's been a big hurdle for many to come back. The one thing a post-pandemic rebound economy needs, though, is labor wherever it's from. And as long as this chronic shortage of labor exists, the average Briton will feel the pinch at the cash register. Saeed Puriza, London.
As an example of popular resistance, Palestinians held several rallies on Thursday along the separation fence. There were huge night confrontations, and Palestinians called for a complete lifting of the siege imposed on the Gaza Strip as a result of the continuous gathering by the borders that has been going on for almost 2 weeks. The Israeli regime began to submit to the Palestinian pressure as a list of Palestinian demands has been implemented.
Israel's new measures and facilities are not coming for the favor of the Palestinian side as much as they come to prevent the Palestinian outrage and try to restore peace by the border. Israel is afraid of these gatherings that represent the popular resistance. resulted from the deteriorating life Gazans are living. These facilitations are never enough, and Palestinians want a complete end of the siege.
During the clashes, Palestinians spun tires and threw explosives to disturb the Israeli army. The regime soldiers fired live bullets and tear gas at protesters during the nighttime clashes.
Those are not facilitations. The new decisions are simple rights of the Palestinians that the Israeli regime has deprived us of for 50 years. Palestinians are living their worst times ever, while there is no medicine, no food, and we have to take action. All spheres of Gazans are here protesting peacefully, and these protests are ongoing until all the blockade is over.
Palestinians insist on keeping the resistance, starting from nightly confusion to incendiary balloons and clashing with the Israeli regime along the borders. The Israeli regime has not yet kept up with the demands of Palestinians, including ending the crippling blockade. Meanwhile, the resistance confirms that the Israeli new measures are not enough.
These Israeli facilities are not a gift from Israel. There are legal Palestinian rights, and this move shows that the Palestinian outrage forced the Israeli regime to submit to the Palestinian demands partially. Palestinians have the right to defend themselves and their lands, and the resistance will go on until a complete lifting of the siege.
Palestinians here stress that the popular resistance should be held along with the armed resistance until all Palestinian demands are completely achieved. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
In a small lab in Tehran, a big dream is unfolding. An expert team comprised of over 30 young Iranian physicists and engineers are putting the first building blocks of what would be the first Iranian-made particle accelerator. Also called synchrotron, the device produces high-energy beams by accelerating electrons close to the speed of light in a large donut-shaped vacuum chamber. The process seems simple in words, but it's painstakingly complicated in practice.
At the center of this laboratory complex, a fourth-generation synchrotron is located, which accelerates electrons to nearly the speed of light by using radio frequency systems and powerful electromagnets, and finally produces exceptionally brilliant beams of light in a wide spectrum ranging from infrared and visible light to ultraviolet and hard X-rays.
First built in the 1940s, synchrotrons were originally made to study high-energy particle collisions, but it didn't take scientists long to notice the synchrotron's byproduct, an extremely bright light that can be used in investigating the structure of crystals and proteins, monitoring air pollution, studying disease mechanisms, HD imaging, and cancer radiation therapy, among other applications.
The X-ray produced in this machine is a million times brighter than the other conventional X-ray sources. And it has also unique properties such as high coherency and polarization, tunability, and ultra-short pulses, which enables the scientists to achieve high-quality imaging. Information obtained by scientists can be used to study the structure of viruses and proteins, design new drugs, precise radiography from human body, examine the structure of surfaces, build smaller and powerful computer chips, develop new materials for safer medical implants, and help with the cleanup of mining waste.
The Iranian synchrotron is for now in the R&D stage. The developer's team says the project needs $300 million to be accomplished. So far, only 1% of the budget is supplied. The team hopes by shedding light on the significance of the cutting-edge technology, it can attract the needed investment from the government.
With a wide range of applications, from medicine to agriculture, the homegrown synchrotron would transform technologies. Experts say, for sanctions hit Iran, building such a device is more than just an achievement, but a miracle. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
"We are all in this together" has been the slogan echoed repeatedly throughout the COVID-19 global health pandemic. But time and time again, it's been proven to be little more than intelligent brand marketing, as a global health crisis has laid bare not only the inequalities within societies, but also on the global stage. In Africa, considered the most resource-rich continent on the planet, but the poorest in terms of GDP, less than 2% of the continent's population of 1.3 billion has been fully vaccinated against COVID-19. While in comparison, in the European Union, 70% of adults have now been fully vaccinated, according to EU officials, leading to allegations of COVID apartheid in the international arena.
Some countries are now rolling out booster doses to fully vaccinated people when millions of people around the world have not even received their first dose.
Israel has provided 1 million Israelis their third dose, while only 18% of Palestinians in Gaza have received only one dose of the COVID vaccine.
Meanwhile, the UK, a former colonial power in Africa, is the latest to offer a third dose of the COVID vaccine to around 500,000 Brits. At a time when Africa is experiencing 248,000 new confirmed cases just last week, and 28 African countries are in the midst of a surge in infections driven by the new Delta variant.
And today we're going to go a step further by accepting the advice of the independent JCVI that anyone that is severely immunosuppressed should be offered a third dose.
According to research conducted by the Zoe COVID study, effectiveness in the Pfizer vaccine was at 88% after 1 month, but dropped to 74% after 6 months. And for AstraZeneca, the effectiveness of the vaccine was 77% after 1 month, but dropped to 67% after 4 to 5 months. This arguably demonstrates the need for third booster jabs. However, in low-income countries where there are fewer healthcare workers, weaker infrastructure, and poor access to COVID vaccines, that need is far greater. But their cry for help has thus far been ignored by the very powers that told us we are all in this together. Ahmed Kabbalah, London.
Despite intense negotiations, the Taliban and the National Resistance Front in Panjshir, headed by Ahmed Massoud, have not reached a peace agreement. As a result, the Taliban launched a major offensive from three directions on the valley of Panjshir on Wednesday night to capture an area that has yet to fall under the group's control.
Taliban have had some offensive from the Khawak High Pass, from the Andarab Valley of Baghla. From our side, there were local forces of Andarab, different districts of Andarab, local forces of Panjshir, as well as the ANSF forces. They have defended very well. They have defeated Taliban on that front. Taliban have lost 40 of their personnel, another 35 of them were wounded. 4 armies of Taliban were destroyed, 2 rangers of Taliban were destroyed, and they did not succeed on their offensive.
In the meantime, the Taliban officials say the resistance in Panjshir cannot succeed because the valley is completely surrounded by the Taliban forces. Therefore, the Taliban want Massoud to surrender without any bloodshed, a demand strongly rejected by the resistance in Panjshir.
We want Massoud to surrender. We are all Muslims and we must not kill each other. Panjshir is surrounded by our forces and we will finally capture the valley. So this is better for Massoud to think about the consequences of resisting against us.
Capturing Panjshir Valley in northern Afghanistan has always been considered a big goal for the Taliban, even during their previous rule over 95% of Afghanistan before their collapse in 2001. Ahmad Shah Massoud resisted against major Taliban offensives on Panjshir and did not allow them to enter the valley even once. Now, it remains to be seen if Ahmad Massoud, the son of the legendary Afghan commander, can follow the footsteps of his father, who is also titled as the Afghan national hero in Afghanistan's constitution. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Pakistan has stepped up security along the Afghan border. The move is part of several measures Pakistan has taken to prevent militants slipping into this side of the border. But these moves appear to have made little impact as the number of terrorist attacks has been on the rise in recent weeks. A report by an Islamabad-based think tank reveals that in August, 45 militant attacks took place in Pakistan, the highest in a month since June 2016.
Interestingly, the sudden surge in militant attacks in Pakistan, almost twice as compared with July, was witnessed in a month in which Taliban took over Afghanistan, especially Kabul. So there is a coincidence. It is yet to be verified that is there a direct link or not, but it is a strange coincidence.
According to the report, the number of militant attacks continue to go up since May, when the US-led foreign forces